Welcome, everyone, to the Q&A session for our upcoming course, The Shamanic Path of Reenchantment, the 7-week journey to discover both traditional practices and new portals to wisdom, healing, and joy. This is Lisa Bonice, and I'm delighted to be hosting this conversation for the Shift Network, where we'll explore the teachings of Hank Wesselman and address questions about his upcoming 7-week course, The Shamanic Path of Reenchantment, which begins Thursday, December 1st. We'll talk about the course in just a few minutes, but first I want to introduce our guest. Hank Wesselman has worked for more than 45 years with scientists investigating the mystery of human origins in the fossil beds of eastern Africa's Great Rift Valley, and he spent much of his life living with indigenous tribal people. The books in his autobiographical trilogy, Spirit Walker, Medicine Maker, and Vision Seeker, have been published in 13 languages. He also co-authored the award-winning Awakening to the Spirit World with a fellow shamanic practitioner, Sandra Ingerman. His book, The Bowl of Light, gives us a privileged look into the mind of an authentic Hawaiian kahuna mystic, providing us with insights into the end of this cycle of ages and the beginning of the next. His new release is The Reenchantment, A Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder, in which the kahuna has left deep footprints. Welcome, Hank. It is such a pleasure to have you with us tonight.
Hey, Lisa. Here I am. I'm on Hawaii Island, so greetings to everyone from this wonderful place. You know, I live in a place that looks like Tahiti, that looks like paradise. I know it's tough, but somebody's got to live here.
Yes,
I have a small organic farm and where we grow food, and you know, it's just, you know, it's a wonderful thing. It's just a wonderful thing.
Sounds like it. Sounds like you've been able to carve out just the perfect life for yourself. That's awesome. Well done, sir. Well done.
Well, perfect, yeah. I don't know, but a life, it's definitely a life.
Sounds terrific. So we have the rest of our time together to chat about your work and your upcoming course. Again, the name of that course is The Shamanic Path of Reenchantment, which I think is just an intriguing title. I've read the website, and, ooh, I can't wait to see what your course has. And, again, that begins Thursday, December 1st. And if any time during this call our listeners want to learn more about this 7-week course, you can go ahead and visit shamanicpathcourse.com. Again, that is shamanicpathcourse.com. There's no spaces between those words, and you'll be able to see the full description of the course and to register. So why don't we start out with, would you mind telling us just a little bit about your work as an anthropologist, digging up our fossil ancestors? That just sounds so awesome. That was, what, in the Great Rift Valley of Ethiopia? Is that right?
That's right. You know, when I was a grad student at Berkeley, at UC Berkeley in California, I fell into line with a professor named Professor F. Clark Howell, who was running an expedition in eastern Africa in association with the famous Leakey family. And so he invited me in 1971 to go into the field and pursue a very interesting investigation to reconstruct the paleoenvironments of early man sites at the time they were laid down. This is in alignment with my background as a zoologist. I got my bachelor's and master's degree in zoology at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And so, you know, in investigating these early man sites, which dated at that time between 800,000 and 3.5 million years ago, what I would do is I would go to these sites and fine screen the sediments through sieves in the Omo River in southwestern Ethiopia and extract the bones, the small bones of very, you know, unappreciated small mammals like rodents and bats and mice and shrews you know, hedgehogs and galagos and mongooses. You know, these tend to be animals which are very habitat specific in the sense that they live their lives in a very small home range over a very short period of time. And if I could find them at these early man sites, I could tell a great deal about the site at the time it was laid down by comparing their fossilized bones to their modern descendants at places like the British Museum in London and the Museum of Central Africa in Tervuren in Belgium. So, and, you know, this led me on a merry chase across many years. The interesting thing for me is that it was during this time in Ethiopia that I began to have visions. I began to have spontaneous visionary experiences. And I've talked about some of these in the book, The Reenchantment. The reason I bring this up is because, you know, I grew up in New York City, and my mother or my nanny used to take me to Central Park on a regular basis. And, you know, I fell in with the squirrels and the pigeons and the trees. You know, I became aware of the fact that these beings were just like me, but they were different. And then, you know, there was the zoo in Central Park, the Central Park Zoo, where I encountered animals like hippos and crocs and birds and seals. And I remember one day encountering an extraordinary creature in a cage. It was a leopard. And, you know, when I looked at this through my 3 or 4 year old eyes, this was the most extraordinary creature I'd ever seen. I'd never encountered a being like this. And I remember, you know, sort of watching this leopard and drifting into a dreamlike state. Here I am, this little boy, okay? And, you know, I found myself in a place of blueness, a blue place where there were no bars between me and the leopard. And I remember the leopard looking deep into my soul, and something happened to me. And today, you know, when I reach back and I try to recapture that experience, you know, it eludes me. You know, I don't remember exactly what happened, but something did. And the leopard became my kind of imaginary friend. You know, I lived in an apartment where you couldn't have things like leopards as pets, you know, so to
right.
speak. But, you know, I remember going out to Central Park, and the leopard would be there waiting for me, and we would have these imaginal adventures, kind of like Calvin and Hobbes, if you remember that wonderful cartoon where the little
right.
boy Calvin has this imaginary friend called Hobbes, who's a tiger. And every once in a while, you know, the cartoon, you know, panels would show Hobbes was actually a stuffed animal. But in Hobbes's mind, in Calvin's mind, you know, this was a real being, and they would have adventures together. That was kind of what my childhood was like. You know, I had this wonderful imaginary world. Well, you know, when I grew up, of course, the sense of magic and mystery kind of withdrew. The mystery remained, of course, but the magic departed. And then when I was in Eastern Africa, the magic returned. And I began to have these spontaneous dreamlike experiences in the middle of the day when I was very much awake. I'll give you an example. I remember I was excavating a site which was over 3 million years old and extracting fossilized remains of things like giraffes and buffaloes and gazelles and fish and crocodiles and even early kinds of humans which were still in the process of becoming human. And I remember one day I began to get this feeling that I was being watched by something, and it was very strong. Now, this is a little, you know, uneasy-making, especially if you're, you know, many hundreds of yards from your Land Rover parked in these fossil beds, and there are lions and tigers, well, not tigers, but lions and leopards and buffalo and hyenas, you know, dangerous animals that were out there. And I remember one particular day I was working with these three African men. Two of them were Wakamba tribesmen from Kenya, and one of them was a Dasnich tribesman from that area, from the lower Omo Valley up north of Lake Turkana along the Omo River. And I'd been told that this Dasnich tribesman was a shaman, and that he could talk to the crocodiles that lived in the river, and that he could actually swim across the river, and they wouldn't eat him. Now, having seen these crocodiles, this was not a small thing. I mean, these crocs were as big as dinosaurs. You know, they were like 20 feet long.
Wow.
So I remember one day, you know, we were preparing to go back to camp for lunch, and this feeling of being watched came over me, And I remember looking around from under the brim of my bush hat and standing up very carefully and dusting myself off. And the two Wakamba tribesmen were, you know, starting to put the equipment back in the back of the Land Rover to go back to camp for lunch. You know, it was about 110 degrees. It was a very hot day. And I looked at the shaman, and he was looking at something off to my left. And so I slowly turned my eyes in that direction, and I saw something. And it was big, and it was about, you know, 6 feet off the ground. And as I looked directly at it, it's as though whatever it was stepped through a tear in the fabric of the air, which was then zipped closed from the other side, leaving a momentary wrinkle that straightened out and then was gone. And, you know, I looked at this and I thought to myself, my goodness, you know, maybe it's time to go back to Nairobi and have a milkshake and a hamburger, you know, this sort of idea. And I turned and I looked at the shaman, and he was watching me. And I knew in those moments that he'd seen it. And he knew that I knew that he'd seen it. So I looked at him in Swahili, and I said, Atuko, his name was Atuko. I said, Atuko, what was that? And he pointed at that place in the air where I had seen it and said a single word in Swahili. He said the word Shaitani. That's the word for spirit. Now, in those days, you know, I wasn't sure I believed in spirits. You know, I worshipped solely at the altar of science. But this got my attention. And, you know, it haunted me for years, this experience. And many years later, I found myself at a workshop in Berkeley when I was finishing my PhD up. And, you know, it was at this workshop that I met this young woman called Sandra Engerman. She was a student at that time at the CIIS in San Francisco. I was a student at Berkeley. And, you know, there was an exercise with the great Michael Harner himself in which we were encouraged to team up with somebody we didn't know and, you know, engage in a shamanic journey into the other world to find a spirit helper for your partner. And so in this particular journey, Sandra Engerman, this lovely young woman with long dark hair and dark eyes, you know, she was journeying on my behalf to find a helping spirit. And I'm lying on my back with the great Michael Harner blamming away on his drum in the darkness. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my goodness, what if she doesn't find anything? You know, I was having those thoughts. And suddenly she sits up next to me and she gives me this intense look. And she leans across, and I remember her long hair drifting across my face. And she plants her mouth on my chest and starts blowing into my heart. And something happened. You know, I felt this extraordinary tingling sensation, and something was happening, but I wasn't sure what it was. And then when the drumming came to closure, Sandra Engerman told me this story about her shamanic journey into the other world, where she encountered a being who said it was once one of my friends and wanted to come back into my life once again. And then she described the leopard. And I was sort of stunned because, you know, I mean, nobody knew about my relationship with this leopard spirit. Nobody. And, you know, this got my attention, Lisa. It was the beginning, I think, of my reenchantment, that and what happened to me in the fossil beds in East Africa. And the whole, you know, trip from that point on was either uphill or downhill, depending on how you sort of perceive it. But, you know, my books in the Spirit Walker trilogy describe what happened next, about how I was drawn into connection with the mind and soul and body of a man who lives in the future. And that's really all history now. You know, those books did very well, and they still are. So, you know, this is how I got started. You know, it happened out there in East Africa in the Great Rift Valley. And those eroded, you know, surreal landforms where, you know, nothing seemed to work the same way, you know. There were these things that happened to me in the middle of the day, sometimes, or at night, classic out-of-the-body experiences. And this is where my re-enchantment really began. And it was always in connection with nature. I always seemed to have these mystical experiences when I was embedded in nature in some dramatic way, like living in a tent at safari camp for 3 months at a time, you know. It's one thing to go camping over Labor Day weekend and come home on Monday night and have a shave and a shower and get cleaned up, but it's something quite different to live in a tent at safari camp for 3 months, you know, surrounded by a gazillion square miles of wild country and wild animals. And this is where it all began.
Wow. Well, it almost sounds like you're a natural shaman. And before I go any further with that, would you say that that is a thing where some people are natural shamans, or do you think that everybody has the ability to go on shamanic journeys? And while we're at it, why don't you go ahead and just tell us, what is a shaman and how do they differ from medicine people or priests?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question because In my experience, all shamans are medicine people, but not all medicine people are shamans. What do I mean by this? Well, in my connection with indigenous people across the years, and that includes many different tribal groups in Africa, including American Indians here in North America and in Central America and so forth and so on, in my experience, most medicine people are not shamans, but they fulfill social roles more like those of priests or priestesses in our organized religions. What I mean by this is that they tend to serve as ceremonial leaders. They tend to serve as ritualists. And this is not to detract from the work that they do, because it's in the hands of very capable hands of medicine people that the balance and harmony of indigenous communities is held. And, you know, the ceremonialist is the one who maintains a good relationship with the powers of nature that exist all around them. And in that sense, you know, they do serve in a way as shamans. But the interesting thing about ceremonialists and ritualists is that they do their main work here in this world. And I'm talking about the physical world of things seen. The shaman does their main work in the hidden worlds of things hidden. You know, indigenous people perceive the world as being made up of two halves, the world of things seen and the world of things hidden. And they make no distinction between them. They understand that they present themselves together, mixed into one common reality. But the shaman, all right, the shaman is the one sanctified by their initiatory experiences and furnished with their spirit guardians. The shaman is the only one who is able to re-geography their conscious awareness into the mystical realms of the spirit world. And that's where shamans do their main work. For example, in doing healing work, you know, a medicine person may work with plant medicines and ritual and ceremony to do healing work for somebody in this world, you know, working on somebody lying down on a massage table or in the center of a circle and everybody, you know, contributing to the reharmonizing and rebalancing of that person's energetic field. The shaman, in dealing with illness, you know, the shaman tends to work with the spiritual aspect of illness. All shamans understand that illness has a spiritual aspect. Like, for example, there may be a spirit of cancer. There may be a spirit of lupus. There may be a spirit of Crohn's disease. There may be a spirit of multiple myeloma. And the shaman is the one who works with the spiritual aspect of the illness, diminishing it so that its expression into the physical world is simultaneously diminished as well. And the individual who is suffering is assisted in re-achieving balance and harmony within themselves. This tends to be the way in which shamans work. Now, in terms of, you know, are people natural shamans? This is an interesting question because, you know, I became aware later in life, after my father had actually passed, that my father had the ability to do this. I don't mean healing work. I mean, he had the ability to travel across time and connect with the spirit of an ancestor who lived in the past, who was actually a swordsman in the employ of one of the kings of France. My father, you know, when he was in college, discovered that he was a natural at fencing, and within a very short period of time, this is back in the 30s, he became a master on the East Coast, and in fact, he became, you know, a champion, an East Coast champion in the field of fencing. So much so that in 1936, he was a member of the Olympic team in Berlin, where Hitler was the host and Jesse Owens beat the Aryan race. That must have been really something to be there, you know. But he was a member of the fencing team. And it was like he was just a natural at this. And it was after his death that a friend of mine, whose father was a very close friend of my father's, you know, visited me in California and said, you know, my father told me something very interesting about your father. He said, you know, your father had these visionary experiences in which he would find himself merged with this man who lived in the past. And, you know, he knew what this man's name was. He knew what village he lived in. He knew what the sword maker's name was. And, you know, he had these very profound visions of being merged with this man who lived in the past. And when he told my father, this is my friend speaking, when he told my father about this, my father was freaked out because he'd gone through the death experience in which his ancestor had been killed in a duel. And this is something, you know, this is something that he wasn't prepared for. I didn't find this out until my father was long gone, until he was dead. But, you know, it helped for me to understand my own experiences merging with the mind and soul and body of a man who lives in the future, who may, in fact, want to be one of my descendants, may, in fact, be a descendant self. This is what came forward in the Spirit Walker trilogy, the three books in my Spirit Walker series. I would have these spontaneous, dreamlike adventures in which I merged with him in the future, in which I actually became him. I was him. And so this is what really led me into the shaman's path. And, you know, what can I say? I believe, if I've got this right, and I believe I do, that there's a program on our inner hard drive. I'm talking about our DNA. I'm talking about our inner genetic code. And I think that this program allows us to achieve altered states of consciousness, or let's call them expanded states of awareness, in response to certain stimuli. In my case, the stimulus, you know, if I can say this, I almost always had these experiences merging with a man who lived in the future on the heels of a joyous marital encounter with my wife. And what I discovered during my early years in dealing with this is that there are really three great gateways to transcend an experience. Meditation is the first. And shamanic journey work using the drum or the rattle as stimulus is a form of that meditation. The second is tantra, as I experienced with my wife. The step from the sexual ecstasy into the mystical ecstasy is a very short step, if I've got this right. And then the third, believe it or not, is trauma. There are so many people who've had trauma, you know, from terrible car accidents to surgeries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who find themselves in a classic out-of-the-body experience in which they go someplace and they have these experiences and they come back, you know, astonishing their doctors and nurses with these accounts of what's happened to them. There are also hallucinogens, of course, you know, but just because somebody takes hallucinogens and has a mystical experience or a visionary experience does not necessarily make them a shaman, if you get my drift. You know, I think the shaman's path is one of those aspects of our humanness which most of us possess to a greater or lesser extent. It's been my experience in teaching at places like the Esalen Institute in California the Omega Institute near New York, Brighton Bush Hot Springs in Oregon and places like that. It's been my experience that people who come into my workshops have this ability to a greater or lesser extent. Now, granted, you know, I'm getting a biased sample, because, you know, these are people who are drawn towards mystical experience because of experiences that they've had in the past. But, you know, it's, I think, if I've got this right, that about 50% of us have this program to a greater or lesser extent, and some of us are real naturals at it. And so, over the years that I've been teaching workshops, and we're going to do something like that for the Shift Network, it's going to be an experiment to see how many people will actually come online and engage with this extraordinary ability. It's been my experience that, you know, most of us have this program to a greater or lesser extent, and some of us are really good at it. So we'll find out.
Well, would you say then that people who are drawn to this work, because I'm sure that there are plenty of people out there who just don't care at all about this kind of thing, but many of us are, you know, our ears perk up when we hear these kinds of things. Would you say that the people who are drawn to this kind of work are more likely to be able to actually be shamans?
Yes, I would. And, you know, when you say more likely to be shamans, this is tricky. You know, it's been my experience in dealing with shamans across the years that no shaman ever claims to be a shaman. You know, it just isn't done. It's kind of like it's regarded as spiritual arrogance.
Right.
But they will usually call themselves shamanic practitioners in the Western world. And having mentioned the Western world, let me just add something here. Over the years that I've been doing this, I've been involved in this practice now for about 35 years, and I've been teaching for about 25. There's a new kind of shamanism which is coming into being in the Western world. This means that you don't have to be a Navajo or a Zulu or a Kero or a Filipino or an Aboriginal person to practice the shaman's path. I think this is an ability which all of us possess to a greater or lesser extent. But in the Western world, a new kind of shamanism is coming into being in response to who we are and the world that we're living in. And, you know, I could add to this by saying, you know, over the years that I've been living with indigenous people, it was my experience that each new generation has the responsibility to perpetuate and refresh a continuously recreated tradition, even adding to and changing the accumulating hoard of wisdom and technique. Because it was in this way that the shaman's path remained vital and meaningful to those who are walking it. In other words, this is not a practice that's cast in stone. You know, it changes as it travels across time. It changes in response to the people who walk the path. And a new kind of shamanism is coming into being in the Western world. And this has little to do, it has, you know, it's based in what could be called nature mysticism. And this is something we're going to talk about in the modules that are coming up on the Shift Network. I think our last module, module 7, is focused on the new mysteries, nature mysticism and deity mysticism, and the difference between the two. You know, it always begins, in my opinion, with a contact with nature. Nature seems to be where the juice is, where the life force is. And very often, in response to that trip to the beach or that visit to the park or that wooded university campus or the skiing trip in the mountains, you know, people will have these strange dreamlike experiences in response to being in nature. And that seems to be where it begins. But as we step up and into this mystical practice with a little help from our friends, in other words, a little training helps a lot. It helps a lot because it helps people, you know, get in touch with their inner sources of wisdom, power, and healing that are called helping spirits. and they're often spirits of nature. You know, I know that Sandra Ingerman, my colleague, talks about power animals a lot. And, you know, I too, you know, my leopard friend is a power animal. I came to think of him as the leopard man because he would suddenly stand up on his back legs like I stand up on my back legs. And he would attempt to assume an upright bipedal posture, kind of like myself. And I came to think of him as the leopard man. In fact, as some of your listeners are aware, there's a painting that I made of my friend the leopard man, which graces the cover of one of my books, the book called Vision Seeker. And people can go to Amazon and sort of check this out. You know, it's a very interesting painting, and I still have it. It begins with nature mysticism, and then as we step up and into this extraordinary adventure, this extraordinary visionary adventure, we tend to turn more and more towards true deity mysticism. And deity mysticism has to do with our higher self, our oversoul. This is our God self in becoming. This is the aspect of ourself that sources us into life at the beginning of each new life. And, you know, as we formalize and conceptualize this experience, the oversoul becomes one of our best friends. In fact, it may become our very best friend. It's literally our God self in becoming. And this brings up something very interesting about my friend the kahuna, Hale Makua, who I fell into relationship with back in the 1990s. This is, you know, something that people are interested in, the fact that I was drawn into connection with a Hawaiian elder who was a mystic, who was a kahuna. The word kahuna implies mastery. And this guy was a master of the mystical experience. He had a relationship with his ancestors, which was all the time. And over the last 8 years, he and I had some extraordinary conversations together, which are recorded in my book, The Bowl of Light, which I came out with in 2011, which was really about, you know, my relationship with this man. It wasn't about this man so much, but it was about my relationship with this man and what I learned from him. And it was his perspective that each one of us is in the process of becoming a godlike being. And it's our oversoul, our higher self, that achieves this dimensional level of experience. It's extraordinary when you think about it because, for example, Lisa, you know, I'm very much aware, having been a Zen Buddhist for a number of years back in the 1970s, 1980s, that Buddhists believe that spirits are delusions, that the soul is an aspect of the self which isn't real. They believe that there is no self, that the self itself is an illusion, and that we don't really exist. Well, you know, I began to have these visionary experiences, and I discovered that this is a very nice theory, but unfortunately, it's in error. And it's been one of my bugaboos for a good deal of my life, the fact that there actually is a self. In fact, there are two selves. There is our heavenly spiritual self, our oversoul in the dreaming of the upper worlds. And then there is our physically embodied self here on planet Earth. And there's a co-creative relationship between these two. And we're going to explore this in the modules that are coming up. We're going to explore this because it's through the experience of life on the plane of action here on physical Earth that the oversoul grows, increases, and becomes more. It divides itself before we come into life, and it expresses an aspect of itself that takes up residence within a new embodiment for a new lifetime. When we draw our first breath, when we emerge from our mother's body, and then that bowl of light or that seed of light, which comes from our higher self, remains in residence with us throughout life, nurturing us and sustaining us until we come to the end of life. And then when we release our last breath, that seed of light departs, And of course, it's been changed by everything that we've done and become during our life here on the physical plane. And it departs and it reemerges with its oversoul in the heavens, in the dreaming of the upper worlds. And the oversoul, in response, grows, increases, and becomes more. We're going to talk about this when we talk about ancestors, and especially working with ancestral lineages. This will happen on December the 22nd. And also ancestral lineage healing, which I'm going to discuss in some detail on January the 12th. You know, I might add, for the benefit of those who are listening in, that I am going to attempt to give my listeners, my participants, an experiential encounter with these spirits in doing these modules. And in doing so, I'm going to put my phone down, which I'm holding right now. I'm going to put my phone down, and I'm going to take my drum off the hook on the wall and do maybe 12, 15 minutes worth of drumming to help people alter their consciousness. This is something that we'll discuss in more detail as the modules take place. The first module, as you know, is going to be on December the 1st, and we're going to talk about the reenchantment, the Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder, which is actually the title of my new release, my new book, which is coming out on December 1st. It's all very, you know, synchronistic when you think about it.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the shaman as medicine man or medicine woman and their connection to the other worlds on December the 8th. We're going to talk about the fact that from the Kahuna perspective, from the Lakota perspective, the Cherokee perspective, the Inuit perspective, the Shuar perspective from the Amazon, from the Vodou perspective, that each one of us possesses not one soul, but three souls. And how those souls function and come together is to understand the nature of the self. And why is this important, you might ask? Well, the fact is that in order to experience authentic initiation, you have to know who you are. And the self is most definitely not an illusion. You know, this is, you know, something I cannot state strongly enough. So we're going to talk about the way in which the self is put together. We'll also talk about spirit medicine, because so many people are interested in it. And we'll talk about how shamans heal. We'll talk about, from the shamanic perspective, the three classic causes of illness and the four classic levels of healing. And we will engage in a shamanic adventure in which each person in the group is going to experience a healing for themselves, care of their own personal oversoul. This, you know, sort of gives people a sense of where we're going to go with this workshop. It's an online workshop. And, you know, Lisa, this is kind of like the new thing for me. You know, I've been used to working with groups for a long time, for more than 25 years, and I love working with groups because there's this energy that comes into being when you're working with a group of 25, 35, 45 people, even 75 people at places like the Omega Institute. And, you know, this energy kind of, it pumps everybody up, you know. Everybody, you know, sort of hooks in with it. So I'm curious to see if we can do the same thing working online, because I'm always aware, as you are, that, you know, because of geographic distance or because of financial considerations, that there are so many folks out there who will never make it to one of my training workshops at an institute, for example, but they will be able to tap in for this experience online. And I've heard from others who've worked with you guys before that you guys do it very well. So, you know, gratitude in advance and compliments, big compliments.
Yeah, the Shift Network puts together some pretty amazing courses, if I do say so myself. It's some awesome stuff. In fact, I'm looking at the website right now. Let me mention again, it's shamanicpathcourse.com. And the one thing that caught my eye, in fact, it gave me goosebumps when I read this, is the, one of the first lines on the page where you're talking about manifesting the original imprint of your oversoul. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because, wow, that just blew my mind, just those few words.
Well, the fact is that when the oversoul divides, the oversoul resides in the upper worlds of the dream, in the dream world. And when it divides, it expresses an aspect of itself. This is an energetic aspect. It's what I called the bowl of light in my book, The Bowl of Light. The seed of light that travels down and we receive it with our first breath. Now, the interesting thing about this imprint is that it's a hologram. In other words, it expresses, or let's say it encodes everything which is recorded in your oversoul field. Now, what is recorded in your oversoul field? Well, at the end of life, when we return, everything that we have done, felt, or endured is, you know, incorporated or archived into our oversoul field, which means that your oversoul records everything from all of your past lives. Now, on the one hand, we have ancestral lineages that come to us from our mother, from our father. Everybody knows about those ancestral lineages, which also contain imprints from everything in the mother's field and everything in the father's field. These are energetic in nature. But the oversoul records all of our past lives. That means everything we have ever done and been in past lives is recorded there. And so this imprint is within us. And where is it within us? Well, in fact, it resides within our heart. That seed of light that comes into us at the beginning of light resides within our heart. And we can tap in with that seed of light and activate our connection with our oversoul field. And as we will discover in the workshop modules to come, the oversoul is the aspect of ourselves that serves as our spirit teacher. Now, the power animals and the earthbound spirits of nature who are in relationship with us across time, they serve us as helping spirits. They're the ones who provide us with things like power and protection and support. And they can provide us with information in response to our need to know. But the higher self is actually our God self. And as our God self, it's in the process of growing into who and what it's destined to become. Which means that each one of us is kind of like a God in training. And when you turn your attention to your higher self, towards your oversoul, we come into connection with the oversoul's teacher. And the oversoul's teacher is the one called the guide. Now, most people who use the term, my guides this and my guides that, are not using that term correctly. The guide, correctly understood, is the teacher of your oversoul. It's a member of the higher organizing intelligences. And we're going to discuss those. We're going to discuss who they are and what they do. The angelic forces are among them. The angelic forces are among the higher organizing intelligences who are devoted towards being of service to humanity. But they're by no means all of them. The guide is actually the teacher and caretaker, and you could say the keeper of your higher self, to whom we were assigned when we came into being as a soul. And this is something else that we're planning to explore in these modules to come.
Okay, wow. So much to wrap our brains around. Let me go back just a little bit. You were talking about past lives and ancestors, et cetera. So I'm wondering, when you're talking about past lives, are you talking about our own genetic ancestors? Like, are we talking about ourselves and our past lives or our genetic lineage of parents and grandparents? Can you clear that up a little?
Sure. When I'm talking about our past lives, I'm talking about who we've been here on Earth, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. And this does incorporate ancestral energy from our mothers and fathers in those lifetimes as well, which means there's really quite a crowd up there in the oversoul field. because the Oversoul field incorporates, archives essentially, all of these past lives. And it reveals that we actually have three ancestral lineages. We have our father's lineage, our mother's lineage in this life, and then we've got our personal Oversoul lineage, which is our spiritual lineage. And all of those former lives are actually ancestors as well. And of course, as we are expressed lifetime after lifetime back into life here on the physical plane, we will have spiritual descendants, we will have spiritual children. Even if we don't have biological children in this life, we will have spiritual children, and those will be expression of our Oversoul field.
Okay. Well, then, just because I'm personally very fascinated by ancestral, and I'm really into ancestry and genealogy, it sounds like you're saying that what our ancestors experienced in their actual physical lives are still sort of floating around in our energy fields. Will we be sort of like meeting up with our ancestors while we go on shamanic journeys? Is that what you're talking about doing?
It's entirely possible, because Module 4, which happens on December the 22nd, is going to be about working with ancestral spirits, and I will seek to draw people into an experience of an ancestor, for example, an ancestor who loves them. And if we have time, we'll also seek to connect with past selves through our ancestral Oversoul field. We'll see. You know, as I recall, we have about an hour's worth of time in which I can hold forth for about 45 minutes or so, and then we'll journey for about 15 minutes or so, and then we're going to have a Q&A session, breakout sessions, where
right.
people in the group are going to be able to discuss what they've experienced, and I'll hop in on those as well. This is all to come, of course, but I'm really looking forward to it. This ancestral stuff is quite important. You know, this Hawaiian kahuna, Hale Makua, with whom I was drawn into connection over the last 8 years of his life, he was really the one who steered me back towards connection with my ancestors. This is a guy who had like 27 generations of ancestral spirits following him around and advising him.
Wow.
And I had the experience, excuse me if I'm clear my throat, I had the experience with him of asking him questions, for example, and I would watch his eyes kind of drift upwards, and he would temporarily dissociate, and I was aware of the fact that he was checking in with his spirits. And then he would return, and he would give me the answer that he'd been given permission to provide from his ancestors. In this way, he wasn't breaking any kapus or tribal law about things he could say and things that he couldn't say. He's a very interesting man. My book, The Bowl of Light, records, you know, some extraordinary knowledge about the Kahuna tradition from this man's perspective. This is information which has not been published before, and people seem to find it, you know, I've been told by people in South America and Central America and Europe that through that book, The Bowl of Light, that Makua, even though he passed in 2004, that Makua is still teaching, that he is still spreading the word, you know, through this book. And that makes me very happy. And in fact, I do have this ongoing connection with his spirit. He's in the afterlife now. He's in the middle world of dream. And we're going to talk about the middle world of dream. And in connecting with him, he seems very pleased with the fact that his knowledge, or as they would say in Hawaiian, his manao, is still spreading the word, that it's still getting out there, and that he's still having an effect here on the physical plane of action of ordinary reality.
Wow, that's just awesome. Holy cow, I'm looking at the clock. We just have time for one or two more questions. I could talk to you all night. But before we go any further, I want to talk about the course just a little bit. Once again,
sure.
The name of the course is The Shamanic Path of Reenchantment, and this is going to be just a fantastic 7-week journey under Hank's expert guidance, where the students, anybody who signs up, you'll access guidance from your higher self and learn to once again walk in the wonder and wisdom of childhood and be re-enchanted, which sounds awesome. The 7-week course takes place on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, starting Thursday, December 1st. And if for any reason you can't join the course live, that's fine. You won't miss the teachings. You will also receive audio recordings, transcripts, and all course handouts on your course homepage. And also, the Shift Network offers a no-risk money-back guarantee on all of our courses, giving you a full 2 weeks until December 15th in this case to make sure that this is a great fit for you. And as an added option, all participants are welcome to connect in a private Facebook community group so you can stay connected with one another and talk between classes, etc. And everyone who registers receives the Shamanic Path of Reenchantment bonus collection, and those are some good ones. We've got, first of all, an audio teaching from Hank entitled The Shamanic Journey Method. You will also receive audio recordings from Hank entitled Percussion Tracks for Shamanic Journeying, which you can use outside of the course. And then also another audio teaching from Hank entitled Shamanic Healing. So we got some good stuff there. Let me ask real quick, Hank, what are you most looking forward to sharing in your upcoming course?
What am I most looking forward to? You know, I'm looking forward to the connection. This is an extraordinary opportunity to connect with a large number of people all over the planet, really, because I've been told that you guys, you know, have people from all sorts of different countries sort of tuning in. These are people who would probably never take a workshop from me, but it's an opportunity for us to enhance our experience of life in a very dramatic way. And this is something which I enjoy doing very much. You know, I've been an academic teacher all of my life. I retired from academics in 2006, actually, 2007. But, you know, for the best part of 45, 50 years, I was teaching academic classes. So everybody who joins the group is going to be on the receiving end of stories. I have no idea what those stories are yet, but you know, I love to tell stories about what's happened in my life and so forth and so on. So, you know, this is going to be a new adventure for me, really, and I'm really looking forward to it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I am too. I'm already kind of deciding I'm going to sign up for this course because I got to be a part of this. Let me ask you real quick, though. Now, I've read that Makua's teachings say that we all have a primary life role or archetype, like a server or artist or warrior, et cetera. Are these roles sequential, like in each lifetime, or is it our soul's progression?
Well, you know, excuse me. Makua was quite aware of the fact that as we reincarnate lifetime after lifetime, we tend to come in with a major life role. And he was quite enamored of the Michael material. For those of your readers who are, those of your listeners who are aware of this, because in his perspective, the Michael material, Michael is an oversoul field who is being channeled by a large number of people here on planet Earth at this time. It was his perspective that this Michael material comes as close to the kahuna understanding of how the self is put together as anything else he's encountered in the Western world. Huh. For example, he perceived that there were seven major roles, each one of them with a positive and a negative polarity. For example, the first role could be considered the server, the one who is in service, all those wonderful people who are in service to us in restaurants and banks and taxi cabs, you know, in hospitals. The server, the positive polarity of the server is to be of service, and the negative polarity is bondage, is slavery, where you have all these people who are locked into jobs with endless, joyless striving throughout their lives, jobs that they can't escape from. That's the negative polarity of the server. The second role could be called the artist, the artisan, whose positive polarity is creation and whose negative polarity is artifice. Artifice meaning those artists who are very good at imitating people who do have talent when they don't have any talent themselves, and they can often become quite successful at doing that. The third role he discussed is the role of the warrior. The warrior, all of those sports heroes, all of those military people, all those lawyers and corporados and bankers, they're all warriors. The positive polarity of the warrior is persuasion. The negative polarity is coercion. You know, consider the Middle East, for example. You know, the Middle East has been a mess for 3,000 years. It's been constant warfare over one of the most unprepossessing pieces of real estate on the planet, I might add. And, you know, the politicians fail. And when the politicians fail, you bring in the military. You bring in the CIA and the Blackwater people, and things go to pot. The interesting thing about the negative polarity is that this tends to be where we learn our lessons. In other words, you never get a good result in the negative polarity, but that's where we often learn our lessons. We have to go back into the positive polarity to get a good result. The fourth major role, from Makua's perspective, was the scholar. And the scholar, the positive polarity is knowledge, and the negative polarity is theory. Now, this doesn't mean that theories are bad, because theories can lead us toward the experience of knowledge. But, you know, theories, you know, having been involved in the academic world all of my life, you know, theories, you know, you get these people who are involved with their theories and they go to war with each other in academics and, you know, they fight like mad to prove that their theory is right, you know, that sort of thing. This is not the positive polarity. The fifth major role is the sage, is the teacher. And the positive polarity of the sage is expression. The negative polarity is oration, where people talk and talk and talk and talk to hear themselves talk, and they develop elaborate ways of saying absolutely nothing. Right? Right. The sixth major life role is the priest, the priestess, the healer, the shaman. And the positive polarity of the healer is compassion. The negative polarity is zeal. You know, all of those missionaries who are out there missionizing the unwilling, trying to pull them into their way of seeing the world, that's the negative polarity of the priest or priestess. And then finally, the seventh life role is about the chief. The chief is the one who sits in the chair of responsibility, all right? The authentic chief is about mastery, and especially self-mastery. The negative polarity is about tyranny. Do it my way. I'm the decider, see? That's the negative polarity. And it's very, very important if you're going to sit in the role of the chief, if you're going to sit in the chair of the chief, that you've experienced authentic initiation. You know, in that regard, we're going to see how this last election is going to turn out. I mean, it's just it's just a crapshoot, you know. We've already had a president who was an uninitiated chief, and we got ourselves into a lot of trouble that we're still dealing with. And then we had a president who was an absolutely fabulous chief for 8 years, and I'm not sure we really deserved him. He was wonderful, and we're going to miss him. And now, I don't know. It's, you know, it's up in the air as to what's going to happen next. It's crazy making in a way. But we don't want to go political.
Yeah. I would love to delve into that subject, but yeah, you're probably right. We shouldn't go there. Although, I mean, if you would like to comment a little bit about that, I mean, as far as these archetypes, which one do you think fits you-know-who?
Which one do you think fits who?
Well, obviously, President-elect Donald Trump. I'm thinking you're looking at the negative aspect of the chief. Is that accurate?
Okay. Well, in my opinion, he's a baby soul.
Mm-hmm.
he's not an old soul. He's not an advancing soul. He's a
right.
baby soul. And, you know, he's like a big grown-up boy. I don't know what to say about him. You know, I could say a lot of very pointed things about him, but maybe that isn't my role as a spiritual teacher or an advisor. We're going to find out. We're going to find out how he does. I think he requires handlers, and his handlers are going to have a real job on their hands because he doesn't seem to be able to control what comes out of his mouth, and that's not a good thing if you're going to be a diplomat. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah, I would certainly agree. It's certainly going to be an interesting time coming up ahead of us. We're all going to be kept on our toes. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons that courses like this are really helpful, because not only are we all gathering together with not just like-minded people, but people who are trying to understand and adapt and overcome, et cetera, but we're also learning how to sort of face our shadow side and this giant shadow that's now facing, you know, the entire world. We're all sort of, you know, this is affecting all of us. So, yeah, this is some big stuff coming up. But again,
indeed.
We're getting off topic. I should probably bring this back to the purpose of this call. And again, looking at the clock, good Lord, we are out of time. Now, this has just been such a fantastic conversation with you, Hank. I want to thank you for being here. And thank you for those of you who are listening to the call. And Hank, for sharing your experiences with us today. Once again, the Shamanic Path of Reenchantment starts Thursday, December 1st. Again, please visit shamanicpathcourse.com to learn more and to register if you'd like. Hank, do you have any final words before we go?
Well, I would just encourage everybody to take courage. You know, I think this is the most important thing for us to do at this point. With regards to the most recent election, we're just going to have to huddle down together, and we're going to have to just make things right for each other. I mean, there's just no other way. You know, we have to stay in the positive polarity as much as we can. You know, when you go into the negative polarity, it's so easy to do. You know, and our world is kind of infected by negativity at this point. So I think the way to really deal with that is just to, you know, really maintain ourselves in the positive polarity as much as we can, and we'll see how it's all going to turn out, that's for sure.
Right. Yeah, we're all in this together. Well, once again, thank you, Hank, and thank you to those of you who are listening today. Once again, the website is shamanicpathcourse.com. And on behalf of all of us at the Shift Network, I wish you well and look forward to having you on this course or perhaps another one in the future. Have a great night, everyone.
Thank you, Lisa.